The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 43, Peace Prospects in the Middle East, with panelists Omar Cater, J. Bonner Ritchie, and Blake Ricks.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to this session. To make sure that you're in the right place at the right time, this is the session that's going to be discussing prospects for peace in the Middle East. Probably a topic that couldn't be any more relevant and immediate in people's minds, given our current circumstances. I'm Blake Ricks. I was asked to chair this panel and asked to give a few remarks, which I will actually keep really brief for two reasons. One is my computer crashed this morning, so my remarks have gone the way of all the earth. And two, I'm sure you want to hear from people who have deep experience in topics related to the Middle East, both in terms of the humanitarian side as well as the political side. I first met Dr. Cater, who, and he doesn't remember this, but in 1989, I was in Jerusalem as part of a BYU program. It was actually the second time I'd gone to Jerusalem. I'd gone previously in 83 with the study abroad program, but I returned in 89 to study Arabic. And Omar was passing through town, as he often does in the Middle East, and he was asked to speak in front of our small group of Arabic students. And at that time, there's a comment that he made that has always stuck with me, that we will never be able to really understand and develop relationships with Arabs of the Middle East until we are able to set aside many of our own preconceptions of what defines a relationship and a friendship. That the relationships and friendships among Arabs can sometimes put those of us in our culture into a very uncomfortable spot. It requires a deeper, emotional, almost more vulnerable set of circumstances in which you share your life with a person. And when I think of that comment and about the events recently that have brought many Middle East experts onto Fox News, NBC News, CNN, and on PBS. One night in particular, I recall Charlie Rose holding a roundtable session with three Middle East experts. One had been, I think, a CIA bureau chief in Lebanon. One had worked in the State Department. Another one had been a journalist in the Middle East, and he went around the table after talking policy and theory and prospects for what was then leading up to a war. He asked them, "How's your Arabic?" And going around the table, each person had to answer how their Arabic was. And there wasn't one person at that table who spoke the language of the people about whom they were experts. And that has, I think, always defined largely our inability to understand the Arab mind, if one can even talk about it as a singular, and I don't think we can. And it also fails us in understanding what it is we need to do to leverage the power of our diplomacy and other means to help achieve a lasting peace between Israel and Palestinians, as well as other conflicts throughout the Middle East, which have unfortunately spilled onto our shores in recent years. I had the opportunity to work on a translation project for a terrorist conspiracy trial in the mid-90s. when Sheikh Omar Abdurrahman, who is a blind Egyptian cleric, was ultimately convicted and jailed for his connections to conspiring to blow up various landmarks around New York City, as well as connections to the previous bombing of the Twin Towers. It was interesting, as the media reported at that time, that Sheikh Omar Abdurrahman had come to the United States illegally and was residing here to further the aims of terrorists in attacking U.S. targets. Those of us who had studied Middle East and understood some of the key figures who were shaping some of the political movements throughout the Middle East knew about this character. He had been very influential in Egypt as a spokesman for militant Islam. And those of us who had studied this closely also knew that he had been brought to the United States purposely by the U.S. government, with the Egyptian government's knowledge as well, because of his role in raising funds for the Mujahideen, who at that time were fighting the Russians, and that seemed to be very much in our interests. And so we see a lot of gray areas in which international politics takes place, and we seem to be completely blinded by what all of these gray areas mean. More recently, we've launched a war in Iraq, and we have forces there today. And this is, again, raising tensions throughout the Middle East. Some say it's in the agenda for creating a democratic model whereby that influence could pervade throughout the Middle East. And others say that this has ties more to the economic realities of businesses doing business as usual, with contracts being given out to large American corporations. Now, however you want to look at this, there's a multiplicity of different views and analyses that we can take, and we have two people who are perfectly qualified to help us understand how all of these different actions over the past years and perhaps over the past decades and maybe even further back, that will help us understand what these mean and what the prospects are for peace in the Middle East. Are there rays of hope, or is this something that we have no control over? Does the United States have a role to play in furthering peace in the Middle East? We have Dr. Omar Kader, who's going to speak to us first. He is the president and CEO, as well as the founder of Paltech Incorporated, which is a management consulting services firm servicing many of our government agencies. We have Dr. Jay Bonarici, whose background in organizational behavior has taken him to the Middle East as a consultant to universities, as well as consulting work that he's done with the PLO. So these are people who have been on the ground, have met with people who understand the complexities of both sides. And we look forward to hearing their remarks. Turn the time over to Dr. Omar Kader.
Thank you. I'm glad to be invited to be with you today. let me give you a little, before I give you a little background, I've been doing a lot of research because so much of what we're confronting in the Middle East is new. I was reading a book by Avi Shlaim, an Israeli scholar who is out of Oxford in England, and on page 104 there's a nice little passage in there. It says, according to doubtlessly apocryphal story by Pope John Paul, he says, there are two solutions possible to the Arab-Israeli conflict. the realistic and the miraculous. The realistic would involve divine intervention. The miraculous would involve voluntary agreement. And then he proposes a third possibility, which would be United States intervention in the, with the parties. When you sort out everything that's going on in the Middle East today, there are so many trails. And so today, I'm just going to talk with you about the Arab-Israeli conflict from the standpoint of where the peace talks are now. And tonight, in a session, I'm going to address the values that are confronting one another. And I don't think of it as a clash of civilization. But tonight, what I'm going to talk about is how are we going to reconcile the problems with the radical Islamicist, which I think are probably more dangerous to America's future than communism was. And I'll talk about why it's more dangerous and where we're headed with it, and we will see more 9/11s if we don't address it. Let me just give you a bit of background on what I do, because I have so many people ask me what I do and they don't know. And I think Carol Pearson's the only person in the room who knows what I do for a living. She taught me everything I know about government contracting, which is to say I'm one of the reasons I'm successful, I suppose. In government contracting, it's the only single city niche of $2 trillion a year. It's a capitalist dream. And every day, billions of dollars of contracts are issued on an open compete, unless there's an emergency or something else. So for those of you that don't know, we work in Washington, and every day, everything is published. Pencils, paper, copy machines, chairs, training, everything. So I decided to get into training, and I do a lot of training internationally and domestically. And I split my work between international and domestic. International is I'm developing courses to teach Egyptian businessmen how to enter the international trade market by improving the quality of their goods and services. It takes years to do, but we've been working at it about 5 years, and that's on contract. In Jerusalem, I have a clinic upgrade system where the United States government is paying to upgrade all the clinics for maternal and child care health. And domestically, we work with the agencies. I have one great contract that we call the condom contract. The United States government distributes over $500 million worth of birth control pills, IUDs, and condoms worldwide. We call it a birth spacing project, not birth control. And I have about 50 people who do that. And what we do is we go out to the villages of the various countries of the world and work with women on how to plan their families. If a woman wants to have 10 kids, we've taught them that the science shows that if you can birth space your children every 32 months, you'll have healthier mothers and healthier children. We got the science to do it. We found out that most women want to do that. And then domestically, I do a lot of work with the Head Start Bureau, for those of you that don't know. And it's a lot like international work because it's development work internally. There are 2,200 bureaus, and we work with in all the inner cities in upgrading educational opportunities for the poor inner-city kids. Today, I want to talk with you a little about the questions that were put on the table. What is happening today? How is the United States led war with Iraq affecting the region? What are the biggest stumbling blocks to lasting peace? And what should give us the most reason for hope? I'm an optimist, and I think there is going to be a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and I think it's a sideshow compared to the biggest challenge we've got facing us in the future. I think the biggest challenge we have facing us in the future are the extremist, dogmatic Islamicists. That's the term that we use now for the political Islam. The Islamicists are generally a racist, dogmatic, totalitarian, fascist, anti-Semitic group of people who are trying to drive the Middle East into a theocracy that is led by central authority. There is no promise in Islamism. Osama bin Laden is but one of the leaders, and there are thousands more. And tonight I'll talk about the theoretician who is driving them all, who has written about 30, 40 volume treatise on how to live, right down to every day, how to clip your fingernails and everything else. These are not people who understand freedom, and they're a great threat to us. The Arab-Israeli conflict is not the biggest problem we face in the Middle East. I think it's solvable. I don't think it's easy. I think there are two major obstacles to the Arab-Israeli conflict right now. And one is the Islamists on the Arab side who don't want to see a Palestinian state created. What they would like to see is a conversion of Israel into an Islamic state, which is to overrun Israel. Not a Palestinian state, but an Islamic state, and to absorb all of Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, and then move on to the rest. Fortunately for the Islamists, President Bush has assisted them in knocking off the secularist Saddam Hussein, who deserved to be knocked off by every measure. But we probably will see, if elections are held, the second Shiite state created within the next year or two if we allow elections in Iraq. That's what's going to happen in Iraq. If we allow democracy, you're going to end up with a radical Islamic regime. And it's going to take a long time to unfold, but that's what's coming. Not a bunch of Thomas Abdullah Jeffersons running around Iraq saying, I've got the answer. And let's not kid ourselves. And the guy that we've sent over there is a convicted felon waiting for a prison term in Jordan, Ahmad Shalabi, who defrauded a bank of millions of dollars, and he's been the darling of the Pentagon for now 10 years, convincing them that as soon as you overtake Saddam Hussein, you will have a bunch of Democrats emerge. These are Democrats in the sense of one vote, one election, and that's it. Now, what we're facing in the Middle East now, on the other side, I think, is of there is the Islamists on the Arab side. But I think that when we think of Israel, we can't think of Israel as just Israel, because there's Israel that is, the conscience of Israel is seared with the Holocaust and the memory of the Holocaust, and everything to do with Israel is the Holocaust. So it's an existentialist question. It's not a matter of left or right. Everyone has united. And the American Jewish community has fallen into place with Israel since the suicide bombers have begun. But there's one party in Israel, the Likud party, which is in power now, that has never accepted any peace agreement with the Arabs, has never really accepted a Palestinian state, and have mouthed the words, but at the same time annex thousands of acres a day and demolish dozens of homes every day. Ariel Sharon has never accepted a peace process with the Arabs. Even when Sadat visited in 1977 and went to the Knesset in 78, he never accepted that peace deal. He never accepted the peace deal with the Jordanians. He's never accepted the idea that they would have a settlement of any type. As a matter of fact, he's advocated ethnic cleansing, but they have a word for it in Israel, in the Likud party, and it's called transfer. You transfer the population. State Department people refer to the Likud party as move over one. You get the Palestinians to move over to Jordan, you get the Jordanians to move over to Iraq, and you just kind of shuffle everybody, and then you get a fuller state. I consider the Likud party a racist, right-wing, and fascist party as well. It is ruling Israel today. I think that some of the senior leaders, including the prime minister and the defense minister, are war criminals if a trial could be held. And they would have lots of company amongst them with the suicide bombers and some of the senior members of Arafat's regime. So I don't think very many clean hands exist there. The problem is that the Islamists know that for every time they set off a suicide bomber, they boost the numbers of Likud. And when you boost the numbers of Likud, which is that right-wing party in Israel, you create the chances that a Palestinian state will never be created. And there is a dynamic, a direct relationship between what the suicide bombers do and what the Israeli public does in electing a hardcore anti-Palestinian party. So the Labor Party, which is a little more centrist and a little more liberal, has disintegrated as a result of suicide bombings. And today, what we have in Israel is hardly a two-party or three-party system. We have 30 parties running around, and it is democracy run amok with a citizenry that is terrified by all the bombings that are going on. And I can just give you a few statistics that tell you what kinds of activities we've seen going on in the Middle East. From 1936 to about the present, Palestinian Arab deaths in the clashes in the Arab-Israeli conflict come out to about 80,000. The number I have is about a year old, 78,815 Arabs and 11,714 Israelis. And during the last 2 to 3 years, this intifada has raised that number of about 2,000 by 2,000 Arabs in the last 36 months, and about 800 Israelis, and that changes every day. Let me tell you why I still remain optimistic. There is a vision that the Arabs and the Israelis will fight to exhaustion and then finally sit down and say, I've had it. But I don't think that's going to happen. The only way we're going to see peace in between the Arabs and the Israelis, Palestinians specifically, is an intervention, and an intervention by the United States. The United Nations can't do it. The Europeans can't do it. The United States, we are the only ones with the power to do it. And we're the only ones with the power to do it for two reasons. Not just because we have a very pro-Israeli government in power today, but both parties, Democrat and Republican, have endorsed the security and permanent status of the Israeli government on some defined borders which haven't been defined yet. But there is another reason that I think peace will come about, and that is that the Palestinians and the Israelis only turn to the United States for this peace, and they both want to come to the peace process kicking and screaming so that they can show that their publics that no leader is giving in easily. And here's the reason for it. No Israeli leader wants to have his signature or her signature on the bottom line that says, we gave up Greater Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and some of them even want Jordan in that party. No Palestinian Arab leader wants to sign off that they'll never get Tel Aviv, they'll never get parts of Israel that they lost in 1948. And they're saying, I will leave it to future generations to try to get it back. And in all my discussions with Palestinians, I ask them, do you understand that once a country has a nuclear capability, not an inch of territory is ever ceded? And that's where we are today, is trying to convince the Palestinians, you're not going to ever get less of Israel. As a matter of fact, the longer you wait, it's more likely that Israel's going to be larger. And if my Israeli friends, I sit down and say, you know, the Palestinians are not going to go away, not because they don't want to go away, but because nobody wants them. The Jordanians don't want them, the Lebanese don't want them, the Syrians don't want them, the Egyptians don't want them. No one has offered them citizenship but Jordan. But there remains a persistent feeling within the Israelis that all Arabs are alike and it just doesn't matter. If you just push them all across, they'd live happily ever after and we'd have them. I can tell you, even after the peace process, they are not going to change their mind about losing their homeland. They'll have to learn to live with it, but generations will go by for centuries thinking about the land they lost. And let me just give you one glimpse of that. I was, maybe it was one of the trips we made to Tunis to visit the PLO and Arafat. I was watching CNN and there was a speech being given that these things must never happen again. We must make sure that we stand up to the adversary. And it was going on and on about something bad that had happened to the people. And I thought, what did I miss today? And on the crawl, picked up, and it was Milosevic in his early, early career talking about regaining the fields of Kosovo for Serbia, 800 years ago lost. And he was dealing with it like it was a current event. And when I get to the Middle East and I have these conversations about what happened yesterday, it can easily slip from where we're going today over the small little boundaries. And I'm talking about boundaries that are defined within yards of walls and streets. We're not talking fields and valleys and mountaintops. We're talking yards. And one of the great discoveries of how important it was is on a couple of airplane aerial visits with peacekeepers, they were taking this is between the Egyptians and the Israelis, they were taking a plane trip with the UN, the United States, Israeli, and Egyptians through the Sinai. And they were saying, we will go through this pass, and we will come up through here, and this will be your side, and we'll divide the troops. They get down on the ground, and the guy that was making the map and the mark as they were listening was using a felt-tip pen. And when they got to the ground, the felt-tip pen was a half mile wide when they got to it. And they argued which side of the felt-tip ink would the boundary be. Well, of course, it would be right down the middle if you're a normal and rational. That's not. And it delayed the negotiations on the peace between the Egyptians and the Israelis on dividing up and withdrawing from the Sinai for months over a felt-tip pen. And now they use really sharp pencils on that. In Jerusalem, they went city block by city block, house by house, through the Old City. It's only 18 acres. 18 acres. And it's taken years to divide who's going to get jurisdiction on it. Let me just, an aside, and I want to get through this quickly, and then we'll leave time for questions. Here's why you're interested in the Middle East, just so that you understand. Aid to the Middle East, 1949 to 2002. The United States in aid to Israel is $247 billion. Israel is one of the most successful projects the Americans have ever undertaken, better than the TVA, better than the Marshall Plan, better than the space program. Here is a democratic country with nuclear capabilities, a very successful project, $247 billion. Egypt, $139 billion, not a very successful project. When you go out to Egypt today, you don't really see the modernization take place. Turkey, $159 billion, fairly successful, at least it's secular, modern army, part of NATO, trying to join the EU. Greece, $125 million. And Jordan, billion for Greece. All of these in the billions. Again, Israel, $247 billion. Egypt, $139 billion. Turkey, $159 billion. Greece, $125 billion. And Jordan, $25 billion. Now, we put, and when you add the interest on the national debt and everything else to that, you're getting towards $1 trillion we've invested. And what do we want from this region for $1 trillion? Markets. Modern markets. What we want to see is democracies flourishing where people are buying things from us. And let me tell you what our thinking is and how we operate. What we'll do is we'll go into a typical economy and we'll say, we're going to give you the chandelier and the light bulbs. You buy those from us. And there are no other light bulbs in the world that'll fit in the chandelier. And for the next 100 years, you're going to be buying light bulbs from us. We can give you the chandelier for $100 and the light bulbs will cost $25 a year for 100 years, you run the numbers. That's how we think about in the computers that we give them, in the systems we give them, and the laws we try to give them to reform. And that's our work that we do out there. I've been doing a court reform project out there where instead of having a 9-year docket where your case doesn't come up for 9 years unless you bribe a judge, we're streamlining it. We've codified it. We've put everything on computer. We've shown them how to get on the internet. And they get all their training from us. The $2 million we gave them will recover within 8 years of services that they'll buy from the United States. That's the reason we give so much aid. On all the military equipment, replacement parts have to come from us. They all owe us money. It's an investment, and it's an investment that pays. Now, let me just get to why I think it's possible that we'll have peace in the Middle East. They've tried everything. They've tried killing each other, and it doesn't work. They've tried peace. And it kind of worked, and that's the only time you ever saw the economy taking off on both sides where things flourished. But there's one thing that peace didn't work during the 1993 to 2000 period, and I'll tell you why it didn't work. Every other time that you've had peace talks going on, the suicide bombers and the deaths declined because people started sticking to the economic agenda. And during 1993, September 13th, 1993, the Oslo Peace Accords, they were signed on the White House lawn. At 5,000 of us out there, there were Arab Americans, Jewish Americans, we were all together, and it was just one of those miraculous days where Arafat and Rabin are shaking hands, and there's Clinton, there's former President Carter, former President Bush, all the European leaders. It was a great day, 1993, September. For a lot of people, especially the Islamists, it was a dark, dark day. It looked like the possibility that we were headed towards democracy and the creation of a Palestinian state and not an Islamic state. The woman to my left, it was a very dark day. She was an American Jewish Likudnik supporter, and she said, "This is awful. Palestinians are going to get a foothold in the state." The rabbi to my right was a hardcore lefty peacenik saying, "This is the most glorious day I've ever seen in my life." And these two started arguing with each other about how awful. And then when the president started marching out, President Bush Sr. marches out and she says, "Boy, that swine, he sold us down the river." And this other guy and the other, "Shut up, don't you realize?" And they were arguing constantly during this whole ceremony. These are two American Jews arguing. Now, it wouldn't have been as civil if I'd have had an Islamicist and a member of the PLO there. But I'm just here to tell you, there are no clear battle lines. This is not an Arab-Israeli conflict. This is an enlightened
and a retro contradiction and a conflict. And I'm not talking about a clash of civilization. I'm talking about a clash of intellectual outlook. Now, I want to leave time for questions, and there are a lot of questions, but I'd like to leave you with a couple of thoughts. The Arab-Israeli conflict did not start in biblical times. It is not inevitable to have the conflict go on and on and on and never, ever be resolved. It is not in our interest to go back to Revelations, quotes, Cleon Skousen, or any other, what I consider to be, they're not thinkers. These are not even people who feel. These are sycophant demagogues who have drummed up over the years this notion that it's inevitable. And, you know, the more the bad news, the more likely it is the fulfilling of prophecy. The Arab-Israeli conflict will end in your lifetime. My guess is that we're not talking decades from now. We're probably talking within the next 5 years, some mode of accommodation will be reached. And it will dash the hopes of those who believe that the Arab-Israeli conflict will be relegated to the millennium. And that only then, when Jesus is returned on his second coming, will he sit them down, slap them around, and say, that's not the way it's done. Forget it. It's not going to happen like that. It's the same advice I give others. If you're on a diet, stay on it. The millennium is not going to bail you out. You owe high interest on the credit cards, pay them off. It isn't going to end. I mean, you're going to have that debt. The Arab-Israeli conflict will be solved in your lifetime, and it won't satisfy all the sides. They will not fall in love with each other the day after they sign it. They will work together. And I think that the enemies of that peace process are not the Arabs and not the Israelis, but Arabs and Israelis who don't sign on to secular democratic principles going forward. Deeply religious fanatics. And everywhere I go on the West Bank, I find deeply religious American Jewish fanatics. I ran into one in Gaza. This is our sacred territory, and we have to evict the Palestinians from Gaza, a godforsaken refugee camp. The whole Gaza Strip is nothing but a big refugee camp. They've got 17,000 Israeli settlers there. Why? Jonah was spat up by the whale and landed on the Gaza Strip. That's sacred territory for the Jews. Samson is buried there. That is sacred territory for them. And they are battling one another, assuming that it is biblical edict that they have to hang on to it. The same with the Palestinians and Islamicists. It is sacred territory, and as soon as you get into that conversation, you go right back to the Crusades and how the Crusades never quit, and this is nothing but an extension of the Crusades, the United States using the Jews. One last comment on this. We have a danger point within the Mormon community, I think, that is extremely dangerous, and that is a subterranean anti-Semitism in our feelings and thoughts. And that is that we will just pat these little Arabs and Jews on the head. We'll just get along with them. But our real goal is to baptize them and set them straight. And that we're never really going to accept them as Arabs and Jews, but what we're going to do is go out and baptize them. That's official doctrine. We're going to have some real troubles getting to the real hearts and minds of Jews and Arabs if right deep down in our heart, what we're saying to them is, we accept you as you are until you join the only true church. And we're going to have trouble with that. The anti-Semitism, let me tell you, I experienced more anti-Semitism than I ever dreamed. As a Palestinian, everyone assumes that you hate the Jews as a Palestinian. So they very frankly tell you everything. So if you've got something you want to tell me about the Jews, I've heard it. Okay? Spare yourselves. We're going to find that when the Palestinians settle down and start working with the Jews, especially the business and intellectual community, you're going to see real partnerships. The real clash is going to come when the religious fanatics on the Muslim side, religious fanatics on the Israeli side, coalesce with the religious fanatics on this side, which are the Christian fundamentalists who continue with a subterranean anti-Semitism to use Jews in the Middle East, especially the right-wing Likudniks, to achieve their goals of making sure that they have a grasp on Jerusalem. And when you talk with them, these pro-Israeli anti-Semitics are nowhere near reaching any kind of a conclusion that will bring peace to the Middle East. We've got those people in our own church. Most of them are in the religion department at Brigham Young University, and that's where the anti-Semitism and that anti-Arab attitudes emanate. And then we've got our own politicians. And I can't leave without taking one last shot at the politicians within the church. Orrin Hatch has never accepted one peace agreement between the Arabs and the Israelis. He has opposed them from day one. He has never accepted even peace agreements that are signed by the Israeli leadership, ever. And we've got people like that who are in very high places who encourage Israelis not to go to the peace talks. And during the last months of the Clinton administration, he encouraged Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, not to reach agreement because Bush would win the election and he would make it easier for them. We've got people in this country that are that diabolical about their views and don't mind innocent Jews shedding blood for the sake of some political agenda that they have nothing to do with. Bottom line is, we're not ready for peace. As a country, as religious people, we're not ready for peace. And we haven't thought enough about it and what's going to happen. The mechanics are there. You want to really find out how far along we are, go into the internet and type up Taba Talks, T-A-B-A. At Taba, on the morning of the inauguration of January 20th, 2001, when Bush came to power, the talks had settled nearly every issue. And all the issues in the peace talks not only are settled, but it's going to take a lot of guts to implement them. But regardless of what your thinking is about, go to Taba Talks, and what you'll find out is we're down to refugees, settlements, Jerusalem, boundaries, security for Israelis, and statehood for Palestinians. The agenda is defined. There's nothing new. There's nothing difficult to negotiate. It's guts to implement. That's what's going to be difficult. Thank you, and we'll take questions later.
Several years ago, I was walking down the hall in the Kimball Tower, and Omar was political science area. I was in organization behavior. And we passed, and Omar said, I got to go to Jerusalem in a couple of weeks. You want to go? And I said, sure. And walked on down the hall and sort of forgot about it. A week later, got a call from Murdoch Travel saying, we have round-trip tickets for you to Tel Aviv. How do you want to pay for them? The reservation was made by Omar Kader. And I said, oh, we're really going, huh? And they said, well, you know, we've got tickets. And so we went. That was in 1989. And it was, no, not 89, 1981. And we went, and Omar and I went down to Beit Sahur, a little suburb of Bethlehem, with some of his cousins, and watched the three generations of a family whose home had just been detonated, attempting to a beautiful old Jerusalem limestone building, attempting to get some of their belongings, some of their goods, and manage an ailing grandmother and some young children because a nine-year-old boy had thrown a rock at a Jeep. The home had been detonated, and they were trying to reconstruct. They couldn't get permit to rebuild. They were very desperate. And as I watched the process, I thought, gee, something better's got to happen here. And so I became interested in the area, in the Palestinian situation. And that was reinforced in 1989 when I was walking down the hall again, same building, and passed a different person. He says, hi, how'd you like to go to Jerusalem? He's an academic vice president of BYU. He said, you know, we just finished the BYU Jerusalem Center, and there's some really interesting opportunities there. And I said, gee, that'd be interesting sometime. Yeah, that'd be fun. Let's talk. Well, 2 weeks later, I got a fax from George Horton, who is the director of the BYU Jerusalem Center, saying, delighted to learn that you and your family are moving to Jerusalem. We'll look forward to seeing you. We've acquired housing for you. We're not sure how many children you're bringing, but we'd like a little detail. This was in April, May of 1989. And I hadn't even told Lois about it. And I just sort of thought. And so when I got this, I went back to Jim. I said, gee, you were really serious about this, weren't you? And he said, yeah, weren't you? And I said, well, yeah, but not now. This isn't a good time. Can't go right now. We've got a junior in high school and two kids in college. And I've got commitments for this next year. I was serving as a department chair at the time. But no, this isn't a good time. He said, well, we need to talk about it a little more before you go. And he says, come to my office next Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And so we got to his office next Tuesday at 3, and he said, we need to go to Salt Lake for the meeting. And the meeting, we got there and walked in the room, and here's President Hunter, President Faust, and Elder Holland. And after a whole 10 seconds of small talk, that's about President Hunter's limit, he looked at me and said, understand you're going to Jerusalem. And I said, well, haven't really decided. This isn't a good time, and you know, not. I don't think so. He said, well, can you decide to go right now? And I said, gee, yeah. Why? He said, we want you to go build bridges to the Palestinians. I said, gee, why me? I don't speak Arabic. I've since worked on it, but Omar's worked on it even more. He even looks the part. I said, I don't speak Arabic. I've only made one trip there. I don't know much about the area. And President Hunter said, I want you to go teach Palestinians how to run businesses. He says, that's your field, isn't it? I said, well, sort of. I spend a little time in that area. He said, go do training programs. Go work with businesses. Go build bridges. I said, do I teach at the Jerusalem Center or whatever? He says, no, you don't need to teach. And I said, I've got commitments at home. He said, don't worry, we'll cover it. And he said, we'll cover all your commitments. I thought, this is an interesting option. And I since have learned from other people that they receive calls telling them to, you know, pay my salary and expenses and cover other things. But a few months later, we went and we spent the year there and got acquainted with a lot of people. President Hunter read me a fascinating scripture, and I didn't bring my Bible. Does anybody happen to have a Bible with them? Kim, do you? Would you be willing to let me borrow it? I'm sorry. Okay. President Hunter said, listen very carefully to the 19th chapter of Isaiah.
I hope it comes out the same as that translation.
I got the KJV on my cell phone.
If it doesn't, Kim, I'll fake it. 19th chapter, verses 23. Gave commentary as he read. And it says, in that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Now, this is in 1989, in the height of the first intifada, severe conflict. There had been a peace treaty with Egypt, as Omar discussed, but there had not been any peace treaty with Jordan. It was an armed truce. And still a state of war. And so there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Now,
Egypt's up here, and this is typically going down.
One of the questions I like to ask people, just as a sort of test of awareness of the world, is how far is it from Egypt to Saudi Arabia? And I've done this with State Department people. Nobody knows. Everybody's so far off. It's really interesting. This map doesn't quite go down to the bottom, but this is the Sinai. This is Taba that Omar was talking about, where the peace discussions took place, which is right on the border of Israel, where you have Eilat, Israel, and then you have Aqaba, Jordan, and then just right down here you have Saudi Arabia. And so answer, how far is it from Israel to Saudi Arabia? Well, in literal terms, they're contiguous, because you come 5 miles out here into the Gulf, and Egypt, Jordan, Israel, and Saudi Arabia all touch. But if you go on land, it's 5 miles. And nobody knows that, including people who are making policy about that area. I find that interesting. There are some things that are relatively empirical. Not absolute, but relatively empirical. Anyway, but back to the larger issue.
President Hunter said there will be a highway, or President Hunter didn't say it, Isaiah said it, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. President Hunter said, let me substitute Jordan for Assyria. Prophets have flexibility. A highway from Egypt to Assyria has to go through Israel. And it couldn't happen. No one at that time thought it could happen. They would have to cross this area. The old Assyria was up here, part of Assyria, part of Iraq, part of, you know, Jordan and so forth. But a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And President Hunter says that day that Isaiah is talking about is a period of peace between Israel and its Arab neighbors before the millennium. That was the key. He said, and we must be part of the creation of that peace. He said, we must build bridges to help that happen. It goes on to say, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. Assyrians will come to Egypt and the Egyptian to Assyria. Of course, these were the two dominant empires at that time. And so it was put in the terms of the larger world of Assyria and Egypt, who were the competing forces. But it includes that whole... However you get there, you've got to go through what is now the Negev, Israel. And the Assyrians will come to Egypt and the Egyptians to Assyria, and they'll worship together with the Assyrians. And on that day shall Israel be a third with Egypt and Assyria, blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt my people, Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. Okay. So he said we must be part of that process of creating that peace. He said there will be economic, political, social, intellectual. He said there will be healthy, constructive relationships. And we must be part of it. Well, let me fast forward, what was it, 6 years? As I stood here in Aqaba and watched the bulldozers start to build a highway that now does cross that area, and you can drive it. That was following the Oslo negotiations and a peace treaty with Jordan in 1993. Lois and I walked across. Do we drive? No, we couldn't drive a rental car. But we walked across that not long ago, and it's a very moving thing. There's lots of trucks. There's lots of trade. There's all the things that President Hunter said would happen that most people said a long ways away. And as Omar suggested, time is a funny variable in that world. But a lot of things have happened already. A lot of very positive things. A lot of very constructive things. There are openings. When we lived in Jerusalem, you tried to cross at Jericho, the King Hussein Bridge going between Israel and Jordan. And it was a day-long sort of hassle, and you could only go one way. And as I would travel back and forth between Egypt and Jordan, a more common thing is I had to go from Jerusalem, take a bus down to Eilat, take a bus across to Taba, down to Nuweibe, Egypt, take a ferry from Nuweibe to Aqaba, and take a bus from Aqaba back up to Amman. It was a 2.5-day trip to go 50 miles. And now those borders are open, and the transit is fairly efficient. There's a lot of trade. There is an economic market. A lot of those things have happened. Well, I just mentioned that as a kind of reference point as to my beginnings. So I trace my beginnings in that part of the world to Omar and President Hunter. I'm not sure which was more influential, but it's a kind of fun perspective. A couple of other dimensions, just in general. I've since been back. I don't make as many trips as Omar, but I've spent, I think, more time there because I go and stay. Omar's just a traveler. He goes in and out. I go stay and work. I'm a productive participant in the process, and Omar's just a curmudgeon who comes in, makes a speech, and sets up a project, and then goes home. A Bedouin. Yeah, he wanders. My Bedou friend here. A couple of years ago, we spent a year in Jordan and taught at the University of Jordan and the Institute of Diplomacy, where we were teaching young Arab diplomats on conflict resolution, a seminar series that went for 6 months, and had 20-some-odd young people, most in their 20s, 30s, mostly from the Arab world. There were a couple of Americans who were in the diplomatic service, There was a Saudi woman in the group, interesting enough. The majority of the class were women, which is interesting. The majority of young, articulate, successful Arab diplomats are women, which is a very interesting phenomenon. The majority of people in our graduate MBA class, at Jordan, over half, wasn't it, Lois, were women. Very interesting development, portends for the future. Very interesting. But in this group were people who have accomplished incredible things. They're all young and they're all terribly critical of Arab governments and Arab world. And they all want to make dramatic changes. They're all exciting. They all speak fluent English and are out to really make a difference. And they were all shattered, of course, with 9/11. And we have some of these touching emails, one that still rings in my mind from one of the students who said, an email to Lois and I, said, "You're the only Americans I know." He says, "And I just had to communicate with you how sad I am and how tragic this is, and apologize for my Muslim and Arab world who are out to destroy the peace process and out to destroy you." Well, anyway, a couple of other commentaries, things Omar said. Omar used a very inappropriate metaphor with the chandelier. The real metaphor is an F-16. That's the one that really makes the difference. It's really Dallas-Fort Worth that is working on that one. And chandeliers are sort of trivial. It's really F-16s, and that's a little more powerful symbol than the chandelier. Also, I remember sitting one day in the Al-Fara home in Gaza with Omar. I don't know if Omar remembers that. We were on one of our visits down there. And this is an educated family, PhDs in education, a medical doctor, a woman who lived in our home for a year who got a master's degree in molecular biology and has done DNA studies on Arab tribal patterns and has discovered that Egyptians are not Arabs, which is kind of fun. Scott Woodward is actually the one that's documented that the DNA pool of Egyptians is much closer to Greece and Italy than it is to the Arab world. But interesting patterns of migration of who's really an Arab. And anyway, but Rana was in her home and all these people in this setting, and we're talking about the creation of a Palestinian state. This was not long after Oslo. And Omar said one absolutely essential thing is that the Palestinian state not be an Islamic state. And do you remember that, Omar? Everybody in the room just came unglued. Couldn't imagine what he was saying or what he was implying or what the import of his message was. That notion of an Islamic state, the frustration, the disenchantment, the disillusionment of years and years of corrupt and incompetent governments in that part of the world, seeing Islam as the answer, which is a very popular bumper sticker kind of thing. Islam is the answer. Whatever the problem is, that's the answer. And it's that notion that with all the disillusionment, especially things like communism and socialism and the Ba'ath Party, Syria, Iraq, and Nasser and his dream of United Arab Republic and Arab nationalism. And those things didn't work, and so we're returning to truth, to Islam. That's the answer. And that's such a passionate position, and getting over that is such a major, major sort of challenge. And also along with that is the disillusionment over the years with Arab governments. Omar suggested, and I would make it stronger, that the Arab world has not been supportive of a Palestinian state. They have not been supportive of the Palestinians. They've only used the Palestinians as a pawn on a chessboard or as a bargaining chip, but never, never as a commitment, as a true cause, with the possible exception of Jordan. King Hussein has been a little different, and Jordan is the only Arab state to give citizenship to Palestinians. In the rest of the countries, they're refugees in worse shape than they are in the Israeli context. I was at a conference in Beirut not long ago and gave a speech on the Gaza Strip. And it was really interesting because afterwards a young woman came up and talked to me and with tears in her eyes, and she says, "I'm a Palestinian, but I've never been to Palestine." She said, "I was born in the Shaba refugee camp in just south of Beirut, which is the one that, if Omar's dream of putting Ariel Sharon on a war crimes trial, that's where the evidence would come from, is the Shatila and Sabra camps in just south of Beirut, where the massacres took place. She was born there and grew up and had broken out of it to some extent, was a student at American University of Beirut, and was attending the conference, and so where I spoke about the Gaza Strip. She says, I have never been to Gaza. I've never been to Palestine. She can't go. She can't cross those lines. She can't get there. And she said, you're the first non-Palestinian I have ever heard say anything nice about Palestine or Gaza. She had grown up in Lebanon, where Palestinians are not just second-class citizens, they're a slave nuisance. The brutality of that world, the fear of a democratic Palestine is such a threat to most of the traditional Arab governments, especially the monarchies. They're very, very fearful, and the despots, the dictatorships and the monarchies, which are more than two. Of those countries. Very fearful, and it's a very tragic world. And so Palestine, Saddam only used Palestine, Osama only used Palestine when it was a convenient rationalization, justification, mobilizing force after they had really articulated their agenda. It was never an original agenda. Well, anyway, back to some issues. Let me... give you a visual of Gaza. The Gaza Strip is 5 miles wide, 20 miles long, the most densely populated area on Earth. It is a very interesting area. It is, and that includes Cairo and Bombay and Calcutta and Rio and Sao Paulo. In that area, there are 4,000 Jewish residents, 20,000 sort of own homes, but they really don't go there. They just have green grass, but they don't live there. And in fact, a popular sign and bumper sticker in Gaza is "Green grass is a terrorist act." And keep that in mind for a second. These 4,000 Jewish homes in the Jewish settlements, 1.3 million Palestinians, 5 miles by 20 miles, the 1.3 million Palestinians versus the 4,000 settlers. The 4,000 settlers have 40% of the land and 70% of the water. Now put that in terms of a green grass is a terrorist act, because that means the water is being taken from the olive, the fig, the date, the Jaffa orange, the cucumber, the tomato grounds, and going to green grass and swimming pools and golf courses in the settlement. Okay, now Lois took these pictures
when?
Several years ago, in the Gaza Strip. From one spot in the road facing one way, this is a picture looking into the orchards of a Jewish settlement. She turned 180 degrees and took another picture looking into a Palestinian orchard, and this is that picture. 180 degrees from a spot in the road. This was, for those of you who know the Gaza Strip well, this was down by Rafah, down by Han Yunus, which is in the southern end of the Gaza Strip, adjacent to the border with Egypt. And so these settlements have water and green grass, and the Palestinian farmland is dying. And the aquifers are now saline, and it's a tragic, tragic kind of world. And that view is a symbol of the dilemma or the tragedy of life in that particular area. A couple of other general dimensions. I was teaching at Beer Zeit University, which is a Palestinian school about 30 kilometers northeast of Jerusalem. And these examples come from two different times when I've taught there for a year. And following the Oslo Accords, you had a very interesting demonstration of interest in the people in economic activity. And Ramallah, which is, you've seen in the news often, has become sort of the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority. The majority of Palestinian officials are there. There's a couple in Jericho, and and several in Gaza. Arafat's headquarters is in Gaza, but the majority of the activity is in Ramallah. It's a kind of a cultural center, theaters, restaurants, and university community. It's a very nice place to live. And going from Jerusalem, I had the choice opportunity of living in the old city, in an old 1,000-year-old Arab home in the old city of Jerusalem. And so I go up to Beer Zeit to teach, and I have to go through two checkpoints, one just outside of Jerusalem, and then one between Ramallah and Beer Zeit. And sometimes I wouldn't get through those checkpoints, Israeli military checkpoints. At that time, the Palestinians controlled 90% of the land, of the people, but none of the roads, nothing in between. And so to get between, you have to cross government military checkpoints. And it's very difficult and very harassing. It sometimes takes hours to get across. Anyway, so it's often, sometimes I wouldn't get through, but I have a very good passport that usually gets me through. But at least a third of the time, at least one out of every three times, my students couldn't get through. They couldn't get through the checkpoints to get to class. I'm used to classes being Monday, Wednesday, Friday. In that world, it would be Monday, Wednesday, Saturday. Friday and Sunday were off days for the school because of Muslim and Christian students. Beer Zeit is a Christian school, and 90% of the students are Muslim. Again, many people don't realize the strength of the Christian community in that part of the world, and the fact that many of the leaders of the movements in the PLO are Christian. A Catholic priest heads up one of the most violent of the movements in the Palestinian Authority, and a good percentage of the PLO are Christians, and it's not a war, it's not a religious war. It's a nationalist war. It's a war of dignity and nationalism. It's not a war of religion. And as Omar said, it doesn't go back to biblical times. I've worked on many projects where they work together, and much of the persecution is directed against Christian. It's not a Jewish-Islamic war. At any rate, they have Christian and Palestinian students and Muslim students, and so we only meet, we don't meet on Thursday and, or on Friday. We don't meet Friday and Sunday. And so, at least a third of the classes don't carry, and it's an awkward third because sometimes it's a third of the students are there and another two-thirds not. But one day a student turned in a paper, and there was a different name on the paper. There's no records in the university with names on them. They all just have numbers to prevent anybody from getting access to the names of the students. They have numbers that are arbitrarily assigned. They're not even ID numbers. And so on papers, those students turn in their name because I used the paper, and they had to turn in the paper every day to talk about the issues, to talk about concepts. They had to write about the reading assignments and about issues. And there's a different name on this paper. I said, geez, you know, who's this? This isn't you. He says, no, this is who I have to be today. I said, really? He says, yeah, I've got a different set of IDs today. He said, my brother got in trouble, and I could never get through the checkpoint if I was honest about who I was, and so I have to be a different identity. Every one of those kids has multiple identities, multiple ID cards, multiple ways of coping with an uncertain, punishing world of trying to get to school. A very interesting, very powerful force. Well, during that time, there was an election, a student government election. And student governments have the same political parties or the same political movements as exist in the larger culture. And so you have Hamas, you have Fatah, Arafat's group of the PLO, you have Islamic Jihad, you have the Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine. You have these various groups, and they each field candidates, and they run on the national platform of the movement. And some of these movements, a couple of them, are headquartered in Damascus, which is another story. I was beaten up one day in Damascus outside the Popular Front headquarters. I don't know if I've ever told you about that, Omar. And, or did I? Well, anyway, it's a fun world. It's a really exciting world. I mean, I was just a neutral, passing observer and trying to understand the terrorist movements coming out of Damascus. But at any rate, these parties run students for student office. And after the Oslo Accords, Fatah, Arafat's moderate group, and Arafat's group is the moderate group in the PLO, received a high percentage, the vast majority of the votes. Because people had jobs and a hope in the future. When those jobs and hopes go down, the Fatah votes go down to 20%, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Brotherhood and Democratic Front votes go up to to 80%, and they gain the power. The swing vote is not 10 or 15%, it's 70% of the votes. And when things are looking good and there are jobs, there's an economic hope in the future, then the support for terrorism goes down. And while that 10 or 15% of hardcore terrorists, the Islamists that Omar's talking about, that doesn't go away, but they lose the infrastructure support that they so desperately need to mount their internal campaigns. And that's what negates terrorism. It's not that that 10 or 20% goes away. It's that the infrastructure that supports them dries up because people have jobs and a hope and they move in a different direction. Well, anyway, so I watched those votes swing with the ups and downs of the peace process and the disillusionment with Israel, the disillusionment with America, the disillusionment with the PLO. And much of the terrorism and much of the movement within the streets of Palestine is anti-Arafat. It's anti-PLO. It's groups that are trying to show he does not have power, that he doesn't control the street, and that they're the ones that should be in charge. And so much of what we see as external is an internal struggle for power within the Palestinian movement. And that's an important dynamic to understand. The same as the Islamist, we were in Saudi Arabia not long ago, and the Islamists there were anxious for us to overthrow Saddam because then they could replace it with a Taliban type of government, which I agree with Omar, if there were an election, that's what you would get in Iraq. And that's a very scary kind of reality, because the history, the tradition, and the disillusionment with the West and the disillusionment with Arab governments means we have to return to that Islamic reality, and we have to deal with that in very, very creative fashion. I was in Egypt when the war started a few weeks ago, meeting with a group of Egyptian executives, and to a person, all 30 of them, wanted Saddam out with a vengeance. They all find him a nuisance, they all find him evil, they all find him very troublesome, and they want him out. And they celebrate his ouster. But right behind their contempt for Saddam is their contempt for America. And the celebrations are that Saddam is out, not that America is in. And they're very fearful of what America will do. They see on Al Jazeera, Israelis shooting Palestinians and Americans shooting Iraqis. They see Israeli occupation of Palestine and American occupation of Iraq. And they equate the two. They're parallel. And they find that brutality and that obsession and that control with that tradition of a colonial power that's not terribly noble in that part of the world, going way back, Ottomans or whatever, or back to Romans, go back wherever you want, the Mongols. But more recently, of course, is the West, France and Britain, as colonial powers that don't have a brilliant legacy in that world in terms of doing things that are moral and that are noble, and they're very suspicious of our motives because that's all they know. Well, anyway, with that, let me just turn to one last sort of message here. I do suggest, yeah. Omar suggests you look at Taba online to get the details of the Accords, and I agree. I suggest you read this book. This is one of the most powerful statements I have ever come across in terms of war. It's Chris Hedges, who's a New York Times foreign correspondent, works with Tom Friedman. It's his discussion of war, the force that gives us meaning. And he argues that we need wars to provide meaning. Let me read a short paragraph here. The rush of battle is a potent, lethal addiction. War is a drug. When I ingested for many years, as a correspondent in Bosnia and Kashmir and Colombia and various Central America, as well as in the Middle East, it is peddled by mythmakers, historians, war correspondents, filmmakers, novelists, and the state, all of whom endow it with qualities it should not possess. Excitement, exoticism, power, chances to rise above our small station in life in a bizarre and fantastic universe that has a grotesque and dark beauty. It dominates culture, distorts memory, corrupts language, infects everything around it, even humor, which becomes preoccupied with the grim perversion of smut and death. Fundamental questions about the meaning or meaninglessness of our place on the planet are laid bare when those around us sink to the lowest depths. War exposes our capacity for evil that lurks not far below the surface within all of us. And this is why it is so hard for many of us to discuss it. It's a very powerful force that this is a wonderful story. Another book I would recommend strongly is Peter Moss's book, Love Thy Neighbor, where he talks about the process by which in Bosnia, Kosovo, normal, rational human beings turn torture into entertainment. turn killing and torture into entertainment, similar to the Romans in the arenas or the Colosseum, and the fact that we have this incredible capacity for enjoying the process of seeing the suffering of others. And that is my and his definition of evil. Well, as I look at that world, and as I pray and plead for a change, let me just show you the some symbols that I think tell a story that is critical. These are all pictures that Lois took, and these are not truth. These are a lens perspective. This is a perspective that is attempts to capture a partial truth. And my take on the Middle East is not truth. I've become an apologist, in a way, and I accept responsibility for it, but I'm not attempting to tell the whole story. I'm telling a part of a story. I'm telling my story. It's truth for me, but it's not universal. So understand that. These pictures are captures of Palestinian children who deserve something more than tear gas grenades. A little boy on the streets of Palestine, of Jerusalem, a little boy in a doorway crying for peace, loving. Thanks, Robert. Appreciate that. These are two little children that lived next door to me. Lois wasn't with me on this semester, in the Christian quarter of old Jerusalem. And this little boy's dressed as a monk. His sister's a little embarrassed at him, but we became good friends. And these kids deserve a lot more than they get under normal conditions. This is a refugee camp school with boys, fun, loving. A little boy in a hospital hit by a rubber bullet. I was going to bring my rubber bullet, but I forgot. You know, I've been hit by those rubber bullets, and they hurt. He was hit in the head. That's dangerous. I was hit in the side. That hurts, but I've only been shot at 4 times. But it's a process of creating real power and commitment. Kids looking over a wall, cute, posing, fun, wanting peace. Look at this little boy. Notice his T-shirt. Says, just love. He's eating a falafel, which is very good food, by the way. These are two darling little girls in a refugee camp school. I can't remember where. Was this in Jordan? Needing materials. I showed these pictures one day. I did a year as dean of the business school at Utah Valley State College and did this. And a student group came in when they heard I was on my way back to Jordan with boxes and didn't have room to pack them all, of books, pencils, paper, and things to take to the children in the school that need peace, that need love, that need these things, and are so desperate. This is a painting by a child, a 12-year-old, in a school. This is a very telling painting. Lois took this picture of the painting, which I think was on a hall. Wasn't it in the hallway of the school? And this was following Oslo. And this is a very different painting than we saw in 1989, where they were all violent paintings. They're not violent now from the majority of kids. They're sad paintings. This is the Dove of Peace, impaled on a barbed wire fence. But it is the Dove of Peace, and it still has an olive branch in its mouth. And it's a sad picture. It's not a vicious picture. The dove is bleeding, and the blood is dripping down from the dove to the ground to nourish the new olive trees that are growing up. This is a Palestinian girl who cares more about peace than most of us do, who's willing to put something forward that says, I care and I want to make a difference. I want to reach this world. And we're crying, we're praying for this kind of solution. And in the absence of that, we just sit back and take notes as people die. This is the last one I'll put on. This is, of course, a granddaughter who's dressed in Palestinian clothes and hemming it up a little bit. I don't know where she got that from, but it's an attempt. You know, the kids of Palestine deserve the same love, the same peace, the same opportunity as the kids of of Salt Lake or San Francisco or Texas. And it's our job to make that happen, and only America can bring that off. And now is the opportunity for us to do it, because with the Iraq situation, we have an incredible world image opportunity. Disaster opportunity. And that can only be filled as we do intervene in Palestine and Israel to bring about. I don't like the arrogance of the roadmap of as a symbol. That suggests we have the map for the world. But we are the force that has to facilitate a process that brings that peace. And if a good will come out of the Iraqi war, I don't know what's going to happen in Iraq. There's still a lot to go there. And Bob would agree with me. Victory in a bad war is not a validation. Yeah, and it's a tragic logic of the right-wing talk show hosts who employ that logic that since you win the war, it validates the whole enterprise. Sad. But we do have now the imperative, not an opportunity, an absolute imperative. It will crash if we don't move decisively and aggressively, and a lot of people realize that, to solve the Palestinian issue. Okay.
Okay, I think we are officially done in about 1 minute's time, but if you are game and you are, definitely would like to open it up to questions. So. Okay, yeah. The two books he recommended was War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning by Chris Hedges.
If you want to read the chapter in there that takes place in Bosnia, I think, between the Muslim who has a cow.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that telling? It just tears your heart out.
And what was the second book?
I can't remember.
Love Thy Neighbor.
Love Thy Neighbor.
Peter Moss.
By Peter Moss.
Peter Moss, Love Thy Neighbor, which is the turning... torture and entertainment in Bosnia.
Yeah.
So, question for either or both of you. You both talk about the principal problem, even contributing to the Arab-Israeli problem, being the radical Islamists. I'd be interested in your perspectives on the causes for why that problem has become so great. The media would lead us to believe that it's economics, that they're so poor and we're so rich, and you see that talked about a lot. It must be more complicated than that. And I'd be interested in your perceptions on the intersection of Christianity, either with those causes or with possible solutions.
I'll give you perspective. Omar can give you truth.
The perspective is that the incredible failures of governments and policies in that world. Everything has failed, and this is the last resort.
Actually, I'm going to talk about that tonight in some detail. They go all the way back to the Enlightenment, pre-Enlightenment, and the split between the secular and the non-secular, and how Islam is the answer, and the question is, how did Christianity get so screwed up, and they explain it. I'll talk about that in detail.
I'll give a quick perspective, if I'm allowed. I lived in Cairo from 92 to 93, at which time there was a significant earthquake, 6.9, I believe. And in a city that is, whose buildings are hundreds, if not thousands of years old, there was significant damage and a lot of deaths, particularly among children who were in schools that were built rapidly without any foundations. There's an outpouring of assistance and aid that came to Egypt, including the U.S. government. The Egyptian government then announced weeks after that earthquake that they were proud to say that they did not need to use those resources for distributing aid to the people, that they were able to mobilize their internal resources. I lived two blocks away from a government building that was responsible for providing this assistance to people in need, and there were riots. They were not getting the assistance they needed. However, the Islamic group, which is a known terrorist group to the State Department, mobilized massive social services, as do most militant Islamic groups. They have their militant agenda, and they are also reaching inward to provide services that Arab governments are not providing. So I think that also is a major contributor and gets the hearts and minds of the people.
One of the questions that Latter-day Saints invariably ask is, what can we do? I was pleased to hear the comments about Senator Hatch, because my feeling was that before he came to Washington, the Constitution wasn't hanging by a thread, but he's done all he could to do so. But what can Latter-day Saints do, given the kind of militant mindset and the support of the government policies that one tends to feel dominate the dialogue?
You know, there's a really nice piece in the Ensign from a couple of years ago written by President Hunter, and it's called All Are Alike Unto God.
When that was written?
It was written...
1978.
Yes. Some of us worked with him on this for a year before he published it, and I know that he consulted with a whole bunch of different people on how to say what he needed to say. Our goal was to get him to talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict and get the word Arabs into the dialogue of the Mormon Church and its congregations. If you go back to this, he specifically talks about the Arab-Israeli conflict, how to accept people. I've got a copy here, but I won't go through all the reading of it. But I'd encourage all of you to go back to all our, what's the exact
all
time?
All Are Alike Unto God.
All Are Alike Unto God. And the reason I say that is it's the benchmark issue for dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict in the church. Even though there's probably 1,000 books written about it, I don't think any are as powerful or as useful. It was a stake fireside, February 4, 1979. It's in the Ensign, June of 79. And it's the best piece you can read that gives you the doctrine, the authority, and everything else that goes with it. And everything else
read,
from there on.
There's one paragraph here that we need to read.
There I highlight him. Keep going.
Right there. He says, as members of the church, we need to lift our vision beyond personal prejudice. We need to discover the supreme truth that indeed our Father is no respecter of persons. Sometimes we unduly offend brothers and sisters of other nations by assigning an exclusiveness of one nationality to another. As an example, let me cite the present problem in the Middle East, the conflict between Arabs and Jews. We do not need to apologize for the prophecies concerning the Holy Land. We believe them and declare them to be true, but this does not give us justification to pronounce that others of our Father's children are not children of promise. We have many members of the church in the Muslim world. By the way, I would point out there's a substantial Iraqi population of the church in Jordan. An Iraqi branch of the church, about 70 converts from Iraq, branch president of whom was an ex-officer in Saddam's military. They live in Iran, Egypt, Lebanon, and so forth. Sometimes we're offended by members of the church who give the impression that we favor the aims of the Jews. The church has an interest in all of Abraham's descendants. We remember that the history of Abraham goes back to Abraham, the children of Arabs, history of Arabs goes back to Abraham through his son Ishmael. He says,
both Arabs and Jews are children of our Father. We must remember that both are children of promise, and we as a church should not take sides. We have love and interest in both. The purpose of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to bring about love, unity, brotherhood of the highest order. It's a wonderful talk, and I agree with Omar. One of the first things we ought to do, Bob, is teach among ourselves this powerful force. I suggest voting for different people. I also suggest support of non-governmental organizations that do incredibly powerful and useful work in that part of the world. Because the governments have failed, and in many ways, the Islamists, the Brotherhood, the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon, it's Hezbollah that keeps the country together, that feeds, that educates, that provides health care. And if the systems can't do any better, why wouldn't they people turn to those groups if we don't have any better way? And many NGOs are doing very, very impressive work in supporting those NGOs. Orrin Parker was a primary founder of ANIRA, which is a very... Amideast, that's right, not near. Amideast, which is a very powerful force in educating and bringing Arab children around the world to school. Lots of things that can be done outside of electing more enlightened governments and writing letters.
The church is doing something right now by sending education and health kits to the refugees in Gaza, and within the last 6 months have been doing it. But
there is a new law that if any child of any terrorist or relative of a terrorist or suicide bomber gets any aid, the donor is branded as contributing to terrorism. So the church is now contributing to organizations like the Red Cross and others rather than doing it directly. And we've been doing education and medical kits through our international humanitarian assistance on the tithing slip you'll see. So they're doing a pretty decent job and have been directly involved, haven't backed away from it, but aren't advertising it. And they've continued the scholarships, bringing people over if they can get them in.
It seems to me that every time we get...
That's just for recording purposes, not for...
It seems to be that every time we get close to any kind of a peace accord, the extremists accelerate in their bombing campaigns and their terrorism campaigns. And I wanted to ask Omar if he didn't think that any eventual peace accord that was signed by both parties and agreed upon wouldn't be completely vulnerable to a very small number of people who are dedicated to making it derail. I just don't see that it could ever last.
Well, the issue is every time you get near a peace agreement, the violence increases, and that is true. It has increased. And the difference between a true statesman and a person with vision is the difference between what we have today and what we had when Rabin was Prime Minister of Israel. He understood that people would try to destroy the peace process. And every time there was a terrorist incident, what you saw from Rabin's government was an accelerated effort to promote the peace, so that he sent a message, every time you drop a bomb, it strengthens our resolve. In this case, what we've seen is not just a lack of resolve, but somebody who's trying to destroy the peace process. In Netanyahu's re-election after Rabin's assassination, it's the only time in history that the party that was part of the assassination took over as part of the legitimate process in democracy. So, and then we have got a terrible policy in this country right now of just leaving them alone to fight it out to exhaustion. It is a deliberate policy that says, let them get tired of killing each other. It is a murderous, awful policy, and this president has left it alone. He promised that after he conquered or invaded or liberated Iraq, whichever your choice of terms are, that they would move to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Last Thursday, there was a meeting in the White House between the senior White House defense, State Department, and national security people with the three senior Israeli government officials, and they told them, get ready for peace. Between now and December is going to be the really truth of this administration's intent on where it's going to go with the Arab-Israeli conflict. There will be increased violence, but it's really just a matter of the guts of implementing it, and we haven't seen it so far at all.
But my point I make, even again, the infrastructure that allows the violence to continue dries up when there's hope for economic and political stability. And we saw that after Oslo. If we'd moved fast enough and decisive enough and honestly enough after Oslo, it wouldn't have happened, because it did dry up. And people were getting jobs, and Ramallah was a thriving community, and there was no support. The infrastructure has to support terrorism to make it work. And I had a student who came to me and said that his mother had been offered $50,000 for him to become a suicide bomber. You know, I've had lots of discussions with students over the years, and that pushed the limits of my ability. We talked for a long time. He eventually decided not to do it, to get an education, to go ahead. But the point is that infrastructure dries up substantially, not totally, but substantially, and it makes terrorism very, very difficult. And they will try, but it can be overcome. I'm very optimistic that it can happen if we move honestly and decisively.